Every single day I feel the
Artlist IO.
Every single day I feel the pressure. Double up the work, let's make it extra. Working so my mother get a rest, yeah. Working like I never know I'm best, yeah. Every single day I feel the pressure.
Welcome back to That One Show. What Are You Made Up Show?
Music.
Let's go. Another great guest to, you know, share their story, share their vulnerable and transparent journey to success. And by the way, when I bring people on and we're sharing a story and the journey to their success, it doesn't mean that they're done. You know, some of people are just getting started, but they've had some success and the journey is important to hear. And I love the fact that we bring people on that have they share the journey at all different stages of the journey, which is really important, because sometimes I might bring somebody on that's sharing the journey from going to start to a million. And then I might bring somebody on that's going from 10 million to 100 million. And you may not relate to every one of them. It just depends on where you are right now. So you as a listener is important to understand that we bring people from different levels of the game. There's levels to this. And, you know, I want to continue to do so. So today we have Serena Holmes. She's in the building today. She's a licensed realtor, real estate investor, author of the book, The Accidental Entrepreneur, host of the Inspired to Invest podcast, and former CEO of Tigress Events, a multi-award-winning brand experience agency she ran for 18 years. Serena, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, look, we start the show the same way every time, and that's how we kick off the conversation. And that's with the question that's written on the wall back here. What are you made of?
Yeah. So I think for me, I think resilience is at the center of it. I've always been kind of a yes person, and that's really how I ended up coming to own the company that I just started with part-time when I was in university.
So resilience means that you went through some things that you weren't expecting, right? Ups, downs, discouragements, letdowns, what have you. Sabotage. I mean, I can use a whole bunch of different words.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, what's the one that sticks out to you the most that you had to have resiliency around?
Yeah, I mean, it really starts at the beginning. So my book was called The Accidental Entrepreneur, but the tagline is turning tragedy into triumph to embrace my destiny in entrepreneurship. So when my book opens, it literally starts when I'm very, very young. So it's reflecting back on my childhood. So my parents split when I was about just before I turned 5 years old. And the following year, my brother decided that he wanted to go live with my dad, who had purchased like a rural property about a half an hour north of where we were living. And essentially, he got home from school one day and nobody was home. And he decided to go into the barn and he took out the riding lawnmower. And he basically didn't know how to drive and tipped the lawnmower and fell down the hill and broke his neck. So he basically died when I was 6 years old. He was 10. It was one of those you know, pivotal moments in your life that you go through something so devastating. And, you know, my mom just really wasn't in the headspace to care for me. So I ended up also going to live with my dad about a year after that. And my stepmom, you know, went through a lot of verbal and physical abuse with her. And essentially, I wasn't able to move back in with my mom. So I ended up moving back in with other family members when I was 12 years old. And it's not like, you know, there's kids that have gone through far worse. They've gone through adoptions and foster care and things like that. But for me, I think what it showed me was that you never really wanted to ask for anything more than what you were being given. Like, I had the roof over my head, I had food in the fridge, but like, if I wanted to go out with friends or buy clothes or anything, like, you know, I was out there trying to get jobs and I was 13 years old, right? So I think I just always had that scrappy sense of survival. Like, in university, I had like 4 or 5 jobs. Like, I was always saying yes to everything. And that's really what kind of led into the opportunity with the company Tigress, that I started with part-time and, you know, moved my way through management, partnership, and then taking over when the founder decided to leave.
So, okay, a lot to unpack here and a lot of relatability to this. I have a story as well and been through that situation. So let's talk about that for a second, because I'd like to really unpack the... Well, first of all, the tragedy, like when you were going back through that, have you replayed that in your mind over and over again to like kind of get the charge off the emotion? Or do you run from like, you know, like do you try to pack it deep so you don't, you know?
So I think what's unique in this situation is the fact that I've never actually had a conversation with my dad about it. And in fact, my family didn't even tell me that he died. They just dressed me up and took me to the funeral. So my first time understanding he was even passed away was like walking into the funeral. So there was like a lot of stuff that's pretty messed up when I think back to it. And there's even things that, you know, I just was never really told at that time. Like, it was always kind of like he got home from school, didn't go to the neighbors. This is what happened. But then I found out after my book came out that my uncle actually found him alone on the property the day before, which was a Sunday. So clearly, like, my dad and my stepmom would have had to have gone out leaving him there. So it wasn't like an isolated situation. Like, I think maybe he'd been left alone on a number of occasions, which really begs the question if it's negligence. Like, you know, it was one of those accidents that really shouldn't have happened. So I think it's something that creeps up on you. Like, it's been so many years, I can talk about it now, but then grief kind of comes in these unexpected times and it can show up in these different ways, right? So I think mm-hmm. it's something that catches me by surprise sometimes, because I think I can talk about it and then you're like, next thing you know, you're crying. So, yeah. You know, it could just depend on how you're feeling that day.
And you said your dad did not have a conversation ever still to this day about it? Yeah.
Literally, he made two comments about it. He said one thing that bothered him when they told the school was that his teacher made a comment like, oh, I hate it when things like these happen. Instead of like expressing any sympathy, that was the teacher's reaction. And I think there was like a little piece of artwork they had hanging in their kitchen. And my dad mentioned he had done that just before the accident. But outside of that, like, it's generally not something our family talks about.
Gotcha. And have you ever felt the urge to have a conversation, just sit down and say, hey, can we just have a talk, open talk?
Yeah, I mean, I could understand if it was an isolated situation, but knowing, I think, what kind of kid that he was, being really adventurous, there's so many things that could have been different. Like, you know, he figured out how to open the barn, but the key was actually left in the ignition of the riding lawnmower. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of things that I think should have just been done differently. And I think, I just would want to ask him, like, what were you thinking? Like, and where was my stepmom? And, you know, I even had a session with a medium about a year and a half ago, and I only asked one question. This medium actually went through a lot of stuff. She had my brother's name, how he died, described where he died. And this is with me not saying anything. So, I mean, if you believe in this kind of thing, it was pretty crazy. And the only question I asked her is if he was home alone on the property when he died. And she said no. And she actually described my stepmother and her daughter and even their names. So it was one of those things that, looking back, we've often wondered, like, maybe he wasn't home alone. And then they kind of covered up the accident. So
gotcha.
It won't change things. But there's just a lot of things that, you know, you're like, oh, this really didn't have to happen, right? So
yeah, man, you know, and every day we go about our lives, right? And we complain about little things, or we get bugged by little things, or things aren't to where we want them to be. We want this, but we're not getting there. Maybe our business isn't going as well, whatever the case is, right? And then, you know, something like that strikes and we start to realize what really matters in life.
Yeah.
You know, and I was reading a book recently, and then I think it's called, the one where I saw this was The Daily Laws. 48 Laws of Power. Robert Greene wrote 48 Laws of Power. He also wrote The Daily Laws. In The Daily Laws, you read each daily has a law, or a day has a law. Yeah. There's one about getting closer to mortality. And when you go to funerals, it actually changes you a little bit each time that you go. Now, how long that lasts after the funeral, I don't know. But like, when you get close to that, you get this thing where it's like, wow, life is short. I better step it up, or, you know, and so. And then from there you take into moving into your dad's house. And I did the same thing I was about 8 years old, and it seemed all great at first. And then being a step parent can't be easy, but my stepmother, same thing, man, jealousy over my mom, and took it out on me, and verbal abuse and emotional and all that, man. And I'd love to hear, like, as you were going through that, one, did you feel like you had to walk on eggshells? And like, what went through your head that you remember as a kid?
Yeah. I mean, looking back, there are some things I know now as an adult that I didn't know then. I just knew that she was very like temperamental. So she could go from being like the sweetest, kindest person to like punching holes in the wall. Like, it would just like flipping a switch. Right. So I learned later that she was diagnosed as bipolar when I was probably like 17 or 18 years old. So obviously as a child, like, I'm sure my dad didn't realize some of the mental health issues that she was going through. And the reality was, I was home with her a lot by myself, or with like the child that they came to have and my stepsister and stuff like that. And I just felt like, you know, always feel like you're the imposition. I'm the child from the first marriage. There was a lot of stuff that they put my mom through. Like, my mom called to talk to me, she would hang up on her. Like, there was just always things kind of going on with that. And at the end of the day, my parents were both like had never laid a hand on me. And then that wasn't the case with my stepmom. Like sometimes she would just get so angry. Like there was different instances where she would like slap me across the face or punch me or done different things. And it was just like my own parents hadn't even done that. Right. So it was really hard to even try to reconcile with yourself, like how she was even doing that. And, you know, I try to have perspective with it now that like she did have these mental health issues. It doesn't make it right, but that's how I've tried to, you know, make peace with it years later.
Yeah. And the biggest thing for me, and I want to hear your take on this. The biggest thing for me was like that my dad, I didn't feel like he stuck up for me and he sided with her over me, which made me feel really weird. Like I couldn't comprehend that. Like, and then even after the fact now where I don't have a relationship with my dad, like he chose her and the new family over.
Yeah.
And I just can't imagine ever doing that to my child ever. Right.
You know, he always wanted me to stay. Like when I was going into grade 4, so a couple of years after I'd moved in with him, my mom decided like this was supposed to be temporary. You're coming back to live with me. Instead of going through the proper channels, she just was like, she's not coming home. So, you know, children's aid from an optics perspective, I could live with my single mom in an apartment, or I could live on a farm with my dad and his new family. Of course, that looks better on the surface. So they sent me back. And that's what I meant when I said I couldn't really live with her. So when we made plans kind of like with my aunt and uncle to move in with them, it was handled differently. Certain things were done differently, but I did ask my dad and approach him in advance of making those plans. Like, I'm not happy here. She's abusive. You've even seen it sometimes. Like there was one instance where we're at like a festival in the summertime and she was like hitting me in the middle of a parking lot and all these people are watching and he had to kind of tell her to stop. And I think it's the first time he'd ever actually seen it. Like it had always been when he wasn't home. And I did express like that I wasn't happy and I wanted to move out. And he was like, well, no, like obviously didn't want me living with my mom, but maybe just didn't want me leaving. So I think in that sense, he wanted me there. It's just that he didn't understand maybe the whole situation.
Yeah. And now, you know, carrying this forward into adulthood, your own relationship, your own family.
Yeah.
How have you stopped that cycle? Because a lot of times they say hurt people, right? And we get it ingrained in us sometimes, like this is the way you're supposed to be, even if this person's bipolar, like we start getting programmed, indoctrinated, right? Yeah. How have you done, like, or what have you done to break the cycle and what are you still challenged with?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, I've always been kind of a patient person and, you know, I have a 4-year-old at home now. So I think I've just really tried to understand even like brain development and maybe, you know, last night we had a really tough temper tantrum, you know, you could react to it, but instead I just tried to talk to her peacefully, quietly, just kind of held her through it, laid with her while she fell asleep. I'm not going to like yell at her. That's going to make things worse. And they're just physiologically not able to manage their emotions. It's not like an adult, like throwing stuff around when you compare it to a toddler. So I think I've just tried to educate myself on those things. And I always try to have perspective. Like I always try to look at things from what someone else would have maybe been going through and, you know, just try to treat people with the respect that I want to be treated with.
And have you gone through the forgiving process?
Yeah. I mean, I think writing the book was a big part of that. Like when I was growing up, people had always said you had this really crazy childhood. Like you'll have to write a book about it one day. And then I became an entrepreneur and obviously there's a lot of lessons and crazy things that kind of happen with you throughout that process. So that's how I kind of connected, how that paved that path in entrepreneurship. But it was really cathartic and like just part of processing it, you know? And I think now that it's kind of like out of me and out the world, it's like, hopefully someone else can use that to find peace or perspective in overcoming grief that they're experiencing.
Yeah, man. And the other thing I dealt with too, was when I wrote the book, Rocket Fuel, I have some of the story in there too. Like I had to deal with the family's reaction to it. How did that go down?
Yeah. So I didn't actually tell my dad about it. And of course my stepmom's friends were all over it. So I think one of them bought him the book for Christmas and he finally addressed it just in the last few months. And he just said, you know, I haven't read the book. I'm worried that if I read it, I'll love you less. And he just said, he felt like I was airing out the family's dirty laundry and from what he had, like excerpts that had been read to her and he wasn't happy about it. And I just said, like, this was a very, very small component of the book. It's probably a couple chapters out of like 31. And it was really just to lay the foundation so people could understand where I was coming from and like what put me on that path to like what I ended up doing as an entrepreneur, as a business owner. And I just apologized. I'm like, it was never intended to like hurt anyone. It was just so that people could understand and put everything together. If you just walked in like, oh, I'm this business owner and we've won awards, we've done all these things, like, that doesn't really matter. Like, when you think of people like Tony Robbins, like, he often talks about the abuse he had with his mother and like how that shaped him into the person he later became, right? So I really don't think you can tell one part of the story without telling the other and have the same impact.
Yeah, I mean, so man, I'm in the same boat, like, right? But I don't get to talk to my dad anymore and all that. So same kind of thing. Yeah. But I don't really, it doesn't bother me because like, this is my story, right? Yeah. That's your story. You experience it. Why can't you share your story?
Yeah.
Now you don't have to share the parts of when you weren't there and you don't know for sure, but when you're there and your experience, like, to me, you know, I got to say, Serena, like, my thing was, I want to impact millions of people. And if I'm going to impact millions of people, I got to be authentic and genuine and transparent with people.
Yeah.
So that they can relate to me and who I am and not just put me on the pedestal for success, right? Like you're talking about. Yeah. So when you decided to write the book, like, what went through your mind of like, where were you in your business and entrepreneurial journey when you decided to write The Accidental Entrepreneur?
Yeah. So I had actually joined a real estate investing community and I went to their investor summit in June of 2018. And there was this woman there who was promoting a writing retreat. And essentially she was the ghostwriter for Michael Gerber's Ebith and like a whole bunch of other books. And I just signed up. So I went down to San Diego a couple of months later and wrote probably more than half the book and finished it at that point. And then I just hit a wall when it came to publishing. So, you know, got busy with my company and I just shelved it for a few years. And then when COVID happened, I was like, okay, like, yes, I have an infant, but my agency has gone from like up here to like, we can't even operate. So I actually had some extra time. So I committed to two things. One was getting the book published. And then the other, I figured I'm already real estate investing. Why not get my real estate license? Because who knows how long this pandemic is going to last. So I just rotated between rounds of editing and like the courses and stuff like that to get it completed.
Gotcha. All right. And then what was the hardest part about writing a book for you from start to finish?
So if I could go back, it's going to sound silly. It would have honestly been just like changing the names of all the characters at the very beginning, because going back to change it after, like from a legal perspective, you want to protect people's identities, like companies, clients, family, all of those things. So like definitely just create a legend and just do it from the beginning, because it's going to be a pain to go back when you have like three people with the same name, right?
Yeah. So yeah. Mine was reading the book over and over again.
Yeah, because it's so easy to miss stuff, right? Like, I think you do need to put it in the hands of at least a few people outside of your editor before it's finalized. That was one thing that we delayed production, just because I did give it to a couple of people and there was maybe like a letter missing or an added word or something. So we were able to eliminate all of those.
Yeah. And then the more I read it, the more I was like, people don't need to, like, everybody knows the stuff I'm putting in this book. And it really is not the case.
We really hone in on like I went back and spent a lot of time on a couple sensitive areas because you're worried about how the people involved will take it, but you got to decide when done is done.
I'm bad at that. Like I just tell it like it is. And people, like, if they have a problem, they got to figure it out. Like I'm being honest with you. Like I just like, I'm sharing a story the way I perceived it. And you know what, if you have a problem, you shouldn't have did it. Like, you know, but anyway, next thing I want to talk about is the events business and what you did in that. And what were some of the, like, you know, you guys, well, tell me what Tigress does. You guys created events to create experiences for people, right? For certain brands.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was a little complicated in the beginning because the woman who founded the agency had like an event planning agency and then an event staffing agency that she marketed separately so that event planners would hire our staff and maybe not know that we also planned events. But it was a little complicated because the brand was fragmented from the beginning. So we eventually consolidated it, but essentially we did a high volume of event staffing across the country and even into the States. So that could be working with, you know, for us, the telecom companies, airports, anything that you want to get like physically into the hands of people. And then we also did a lot of stage productions, closed down streets for festivals. You know, there was one company we worked with from the UK. So we built a 500-pound alarm clock. And then we had 100 people dressed in their pajamas to make it look like a 100-person pillow fight in a building, guerrilla style. Like, and then it was to produce a viral video. So it had like hundreds of thousands of views and stuff like that. But almost got arrested and didn't. So it could be as much or as little as somebody wanted. It changed from client to client.
And how did you guys get the clients? What was the marketing strategy that you guys mainly like relied upon?
So in the beginning, it was all definitely like referral, word of mouth and stuff like that. And a year in, we sat down with someone that talked to us about SEO and we're like, we're fine. Like, we didn't even understand it at that point, right? And our first website looked like a Word document. It was horrible. So I've often said, like, if I could go back and change one thing, I would have been like, yes, like, had we been doing SEO from 2005, it would have been a game changer. But we started doing SEO in 2012 because one of our biggest clients restructured and it totally transformed our business. We went from, say, like 100 quotes to, like, I think before the pandemic, we had 800. So every year we had like 100 more quotes than the previous year and we were still closing, you know, an incremental amount more. So it just continued to grow the business that way.
And then the other thing I like to ask, because you're talking about quotes, and if you think about construction, we got to put quotes in for construction and this and that, yeah. And it becomes a commodity, yeah. Right? Where everybody's just like the same. And it's like the race to the bottom of the price, right? What did you guys do to separate yourself so that you could charge a higher price than other people, that you still earn, you know, win bids, but that not because you were the lowest price, right? Yeah. What was the kind of the differentiating factors?
I mean, it was competitive. I'm not going to lie. It got increasingly more competitive in like the later years. But we always wanted to benchmark a certain amount that we would pay our staff. So that was always kind of like the ratio that we looked at. And I think once clients had the chance to work with us once, I think they understood how efficient our systems were just in terms of how we communicated with them. They knew the exact process of what to expect in terms of the delivery and stuff like that. So I think it was more like the how, not what, that started to set us apart. We, you know, oftentimes worked with clients for 5, 10, 15 years straight because they knew they could depend on us. And it was not like we're sending them terrible people or like if we did have an issue, we'd resolve it. So,
yeah. And then when you're working with someone for the first time too, and things don't go smoothly, like this is something for a lot of startups. And when they're starting to serve people and doing, you know, whether it's agencies or what have you,
yeah.
And they don't have all their systems and processes dialed in. And especially when you guys were doing different types of events, there's going to be hiccups, right?
Yeah.
What did you guys do to keep things smooth and people happy when you knew that there could be hiccups?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think all the checkpoints that we put in place were really good indicators to know if we might have a problem. Like, you know, we would confirm staff literally at all these different checkpoints. So like once they confirm that they would work, we'd send out training packages. They have to all confirm receipt of that a week before. They get a reminder 2 days before. And if someone stops responding, it sounds silly, but like we know like there's a chance that they might drop off, and we would never leave it to just the day of and assume that they're fine, even if they confirmed in the beginning, and we would just go about replacing them. But we did kind of, I took a lot of leadership training. So there was one organization I was part of where, you know, creating those playbooks for every element of the business was a big part of it. And having these checklists and checkpoints were part of that as well. So I think we always had, you know, we even started to integrate backups and stuff like that. So if someone was supposed to work at 6 a.m. and they didn't show up, we had a few people we could always call on.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you were dialed in. I can hear about the playbook. It reminds me of a guy named Dan Martell. You ever heard of him?
Yeah, because he was our expert speaker on the mastermind I'm part of last month.
Okay. Yeah. So when you talked about playbook, Dan talks about that in Buy Back Your Time about creating playbooks and things. So I can listen to nomenclature, different words and hear where people have been, because I've been around the block with not in entrepreneur space. And I get myself in trouble sometimes when I talk. So Tigress Events, is that gone now or is that?
Yeah. So basically, you know, I had built up the company. I felt like it was finally at the point where I could take a step back and start my family. I had a girl that had been with me for 6 years, and I had, you know, been open with her the fact that I needed someone that I could depend on to help me run it while I took that step back, and groomed her to be my mat leave replacement. And she resigned when my daughter was 2 months old. So, you know, I just kind of panicked. Like there was 10 of us full time, about 2,200 part time across the country. Pretty busy in terms of volume. And I just hired a mergers and acquisitions company to sell it. And then COVID hit like 2 weeks after that. So good luck selling an events company while you're in a pandemic and you can't operate with like a big lease and overhead. You know, we had hundreds of thousands of dollars in book business that just disappeared overnight, millions in the pipeline gone. And I just had to make decisions really, really quickly. So I just kept it going for 2 years during the pandemic. And then the one girl that I did hold on to during that time frame ended up resigning. So I kind of knew like things are starting to heat up. Like I've been seeing quotes, like the government was loosening up on things. Like we're going to get really busy, but you know, I scaled everything back. I don't have a team anymore. I don't have an office anymore. Like, do I really have it in me to try to scale back up that quickly to accommodate the volume that we had before the pandemic with like a 2-year-old at home. So I think I just had to make a decision, and I got a release from the mergers and acquisitions company. And I just talked to, I think, a couple dozen agencies in my city. And I basically had offers, like I set a date for offers, and I had 4 offers, and I closed on the one I accepted 2 weeks after.
Awesome.
That. So Valentine's Day of 2022. So it's just coming up to 2 years since I've sold it.
Okay. Gotcha. So you sold what was left, the assets, the systems and process,
yeah,
all that.
SEO, honestly, like it was a staff list, really the website, because the amount of leads that were still coming through because our organic SEO was so strong was really what made it valuable.
Gotcha. Awesome. Okay. I gotcha. Oh man. So that built you. There's a lot of things that happened with there during COVID. Like I had the best year of my life I was in the mortgage business during COVID. 2020 was the best year ever.
Hot.
And I didn't like being in that kind of business. And I was in I was making a decision to exit the company, and then we had the best year ever. And I was like, if I stay committed to not being in this business after this year, I really don't want to be in the business.
Yeah.
But some people, income went away. And I watched all these people, and I observed, how are these people, like yourself, restaurant business, all this, how are these folks
getting
pivoting
by?
Or, you know, surviving? What are they doing? And I just watched, and I had it in my heart, that feeling in your chest that you get. Like you said, you panicked, right? Like that feeling in the stomach and right in it. I was like, I could feel it for people. So I started thinking to myself as I was going through this and planning for my exit, which came because rates went up in a mortgage business recently. You know this, right? In a real estate business and all that. And it came over the last couple of years. And so April of last year, I exited. I stopped my license, but I exited out of it. I was in the mortgage business 20 years. I built with 2-3 of my best friends, 7 branches. We had 50 some employees at any one time.
Yeah.
And I just, now I'm in real estate investing now. So we're doing some stuff like that. But I watched all that happen. So, you know, as you're talking about it, it brings back a lot of emotions.
It's really not something we could pivot. Like we had clients that say they did conferences, they could pivot to like virtual conferences, but we were all face to face. So we really, when we were in lockdown, like we weren't operating whatsoever. So I think just making all those decisions up front, taking advantage of like grants and subsidies and anything that we could do, like we came out on the other end with actually a little bit more money than we had going into it, just because I cut down our expenses so much, stopped drawing an income for the first time in, you know, 14 years or however many years. And then for me, because I'd been doing a lot of passive real estate investing, that's really what carried me through on the personal side. So I knew like I didn't want to take money out of the company, but all the investing that I'd been doing since 2018 was really what saved me.
Yeah. That was smart. So, all right. So then from there, you were investing and you have your license as a real estate agent.
Yeah.
What I want to know now is I really want to know, like, what is your method of investing, number one? Yeah. And then the next thing is, what's your vision going forward for Serena Homes? Like, do you see yourself as a influencer in the business and blowing up your personal brand and getting known globally, or like what, speaking on stages, writing more books? Like, what's the vision after that?
Yeah, I think, so for me, when I started out with this real estate education company, I sold my first property, which was a short-term rental in Florida, and bought it when the dollar was par, sold it obviously when the dollar was not par. So I did okay with that. And then bought a couple more properties that one I sold on assignment, one that I kept and tenanted. And then somewhere along the way, like I was introduced to syndicated mortgages and private lending. So it was really private lending that was my bread and butter. So I did about 60 deals in 5 years up until last summer. And everything was really, really smooth. Everything was paid back on time or early. And then maybe in the last little bit, I've done another 10 deals and everything's really gone really haywire. Like in this last 3 to 4 months. I do have some borrowers that are in the midst of a pretty significant court proceeding right now. And just everything's gone a little bit crazy. So I think even though that was a strategy I could depend on, now I'm looking at, you know, just trying to recover as much as I can. And I'll probably shift that into like first and second position mortgages because I still want the cash flow, but I just want to make sure I have a lot more security. And then ideally I'm looking to joint venture on the multifamily space, maybe do some capital raising. I do have a lot of people that approach me looking for opportunities just because of my network. So it just makes sense that, you know, I want to have my own opportunities that I can offer, right? So just trying to find those opportunities to partner with people.
So, and were you doing mostly Canada or US and Canada or just US?
Yeah.
Or?
Predominantly Canada.
Okay. Yeah. Gotcha. And then, so from here, what's the vision? Like, what do you see Serena Homes, you know, a year, 3, 5 years from now, like, to the public's perspective.
Yeah. I mean, ideally, I did have some money from my business that I put into private lending for a year, thinking I'll leave it here for a year, give myself the chance to research and decide what I wanted to do. And my thought was that I would joint venture with someone in the multifamily space, because I don't want to be the active person finding the properties and renovating them and stuff like that. So ideally I want to do something like that where you can keep like duplicating, you know, repurposing your initial capital over and over again. And then, like I said, if I can get a seat at the table as a GP for capital raising to offer those opportunities for people that don't necessarily know about the space, they don't want to know about the space, you know, and just kind of be known for connecting those opportunities and building things up. Obviously I do have my real estate license, so now I'm just starting to ramp that up as well. I don't necessarily want to be like the top producer who's buried in open houses like every weekend, but just pre-qualify clients properly that see the value in my business background, my investing, and I can help them maybe in far more ways than just like buying and selling a house.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's kind of like top of funnel in a way, right?
Yeah.
And if you can become a listing agent, you know, and listing properties, it takes a lot less effort as far as showing people around. Because I was a real estate agent, by the way, before I got into mortgages. And I was a top selling and listing agent. Well, as soon as I got in the first year, because I'm just a maniac. Like when I get on to something, but I hated showing people houses. I hated driving around. Like I just couldn't, that was just not my cup of tea. Yeah. So, all right. So I love it. So, I guess the other question that to wrap this up as we wind down here, we're going over time a little bit. I hope you don't mind.
It's okay.
Great story, by the way. And a lot of more people need to hear the story. I mean, this is a story that's going to make a big difference in people's lives. A lot of people go through these kind of things and, you know, 50% of marriages end in divorce. So there's always kids involved, not always, but a lot of times there's kids involved.
Yeah.
What is podcasting so far? Cause you just started your podcast and you've been going on some shows. What has it done for you so far, personally and professionally? What have you noticed?
Yeah, I think I have gotten a lot of positive feedback, and it's something that even when I talk to people I haven't seen, like they all kind of know what you're up to and just that positive feedback. But I think for me, it's just, again, sharing other people's stories just so that, you know, maybe you do motivate that person. Like, yes, I can do this. Or maybe I was afraid, but this person did it, and inspiring them to kind of take charge of their financial future. And at the end of the day, it's just interesting hearing other people's stories. Like, I feel like I've learned a lot. Every guest that I interview, I'm like, oh, like, that's a great idea, you know, and just kind of opening up those doors even for myself just by getting to know everybody, right? So I'm not really sure where it's going to go at this point in time, but I think it's all part of, you know, building your personal brand. Like when I had my agency, it was always the brand, like the staff are first and foremost. I would pop up here and there, like with different things, but it was very much the brand, where now I'm, you know, like you said at the beginning of the podcast, like I'm kind of reinventing myself, right? Like I'm 42, but I'm starting this next chapter at this point in time. So it's just trying to show people what I'm really all about, because I was always kind of, you know, the person behind my old company, but not really front and center.
You know, I love that. And I was 42 and I decided to get known globally, and I had no idea how I was going to do that. I was just like, I'm getting known for what I do and I'm going to get known globally. And I didn't even know, by the way, I didn't even know what a podcast was back then, even 5 years ago. Right. And then I've almost been on 1,000 podcasts since then. So but I've seen the benefit of effective and efficiency of podcasting. Yeah. And I started not having a show. I just started going on shows and like pouring it on 7 to 10 shows a week, just going, meeting people, networking. I looked at it as networking and they were just recording it. Right.
Yeah.
But also, Serena, I don't know about you, but like, I like performing on a camera as far as like being in camera and like the energy and the, you know, like I enjoy it.
Yeah. The showmanship. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then one thing I wanted to wrap up with was something else. I was just thinking when you were talking about getting known and then sharing a story, it slipped my mind. Anyway, where can people find out more about you, Serena?
Yeah. Thank you.
Where can people find out more about you?
So I've got a couple of profiles on Instagram. So obviously one is my realtor profile. I do try to take more of a lifestyle approach, so it's not just listings, you know, just a lot of news and tips for anyone that's either living in a home or looking to buy. And then also my podcast, of course, Inspire to Invest podcast. So those are both my Instagram pages.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate your time and also vulnerability and transparency. You know, I think it helps to talk about it. I think podcasts can be therapeutic in a way as well, just like writing a book. But we really want to, you know, let you know that we appreciate that. And I want to encourage you to get that story out more to help more people, because I think it, you know, it's good for business too. But at the end of the day, besides being therapeutic, it's good for other people, you know. And I think we're all here to serve other people too. So,
for sure.
But yeah, so thank you all for listening to the What Are You Made Of Show here with your boy C-Rock at That One Studio. Until next time, be that one.
Licensing Reimagined.